This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als mein Mitarbeiter plötzlich kündigte, musste mir schnell etwas einfallen, um die Aufträge weiterhin reibungslos ausführen zu können. Ich musste sofort eine Lösung finden. Da kam mir Indeed in den Sinn. Wenn es ums Einstellen geht, ist Indeed alles, was du brauchst. Mit gesponserten Stellen wird dein Angebot für relevante Kandidatinnen ganz oben auf der Seite platziert, damit du die gewünschten Personen schneller erreichst. Bevor ich von Indeed wusste, waren die Kandidatinnen oft nicht optimal, mal zu langsam oder unterqualifiziert. Dann fing ich wieder von vorne an mit einer neuen Stellenausschreibung. Das kostet Zeit und Geld. Wie schnell ist Indeed? In der Minute, in der ich mit dir gesprochen habe, wurden weltweit 23 Einstellungen über Indeed vorgenommen, laut Indeed-Daten. Es gibt keinen Grund zu warten. Beschleunige dein Recruiting jetzt mit Indeed. Und Hörerinnen dieser Sendung erhalten ein Guthaben von 75 Euro für eine gesponserte Stelle, damit dein Stellenangebot mehr Sichtbarkeit erhält auf indeed.de/podcasts.de. Es gelten die allgemeinen Geschäftsbedingungen.
You are actually radioactive, and everything alive is.
Unexpected Elements from the BBC World Service. Search for Unexpected Elements wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome to Science in Action from the BBC World Service with me, Roland Pease, where planetary bombardment is a bit of a theme, whether it's fears of an asteroidal impact in 2032.
It gives us only 4 years. It's short. It's very short, but if there is motivation and if there is really necessity, I believe we can still do something if we decide in 2028.
Should we really worry? Or the most energetic, really tiny thing that smacked into an atom 2 years ago today?
Yeah, we detected the highest energy ever detected for a neutrino, 30 times higher than any previously detected.
The Earth didn't shake, but it's shaken astrophysicists' theories of the universe. Also, how a little plant breeding can make rice more climate friendly.
So this new rice variety is cutting the methane emissions by up to 70%. Yes, it's a lot.
Well, I'd say 2024 YR4 has caught the world's attention. That's the asteroid only just discovered that's scheduled to return worryingly close in December 2032, with the force, if the fates are against us, to threaten a city. When astronomers first raised the alarm, the number said there was around a 99% chance of it passing us by harmlessly. Since then, the odds have changed in the wrong direction for me, though only slightly, to a 98% chance of no impact. French astronomer and director of research at the Côte d'Azur Observatory, Patrick Michel, may be a familiar voice to regular listeners to Science in Action. He's directing plans to study another near-Earth asteroid, Apophis, when it flies by in 2029. We've devoted some time to that on the programme. But he's also a member of the International Asteroid Warning Network, and he knew about 2024 YR4 weeks before the rest of us.
It was discovered on the 27th of December 2024 in Chile by a telescope of the University of Hawaii called ATLAS. Immediately the discovery was fed to the Minor Planet Center, which then publishes the current estimate of the trajectory, and then the impact probability is calculated. So initially it was very low. Not zero, but like 0.3% after the first observations. But a few days later, it started to rise. And then on the 27th of January, it reached the 1% probability to impact the Earth on the 22nd of December, 2032.
And I want to emphasize this process, all you're sort of using are Newton's laws of gravity and motion, because that's what's steering this asteroid. And you're seeing just a point of light that's
Absolutely.
Moving across the sky.
Yeah, that's a challenge. Is this particular object has a size which is between 40 and 90 meters. But this range is because we just receive the light that it reflects from the surface. And you could have a very bright, teeny object, but for the same luminosity, a very dark, bigger object. So that's why we have an uncertainty on the size, and they are very faint in the sky. So the challenge is effectively to be able to detect it and then to track it, because the longer we track it, the better we can estimate its initial trajectory and the more accurately we can calculate its evolution in time. And because the evolution is highly sensitive to the initial conditions that you take to calculate it, if you have an uncertainty in the initial conditions, then you get many kinds of trajectories. And for the moment, given the uncertainty that we have, 2% of the trajectories lead to a collision with the Earth in 2032.
I mean, just to be clear, this is you've seen this now for about, I guess, 50 days, and you are projecting it forwards. Basically, you're extrapolating that motion forwards by 7 years. And you're saying at that point, you've got a pretty good idea of how close it can come to Earth, and it may even get too close.
Absolutely. And I'm happy you say that, because even though the probability is low, it showed that we can do something. And the good news is that this is the first time that the 1% impact probability was reached for an object since we defined this international coordination to respond to the asteroid threat. And immediately we met in the steering committee, we made a notification, and that shows the reactivity and the efficiency of this coordination. 20 years ago, we discovered Apophis, also on December 2004, and the first estimate of impact probability was 2.7% from 2029. We eliminated this probability rapidly, that's the good news, but during the little time when it was high, we were thinking, what can we do? We had nothing prepared. So 20 years afterwards, for just 1% probability of an object much smaller than Apophis, immediately we generated actions, notification, etc. So I think this is really great.
Okay, so the problem is to get a better idea of this orbit, you need to be able to see it. But at the moment, it's receding from us. And as far as I can tell, it's got an orbit that comes close to Earth, but it also goes out as far almost as Jupiter. So it's going to disappear from view pretty soon.
Yes. In fact, we can observe it with ground-based telescopes until April. And when I say ground-based telescopes, already now we can only see it with telescopes that are larger than 2 meters. Soon it will be only observatories larger than 4 meters, so it becomes fainter and fainter. The good news is that we got time with the James Webb Space Telescope, you know, this amazing telescope, and it will be able to tell us what is its size with an accuracy of 10%, which is good because it's better to know whether it's 40 meter or 90 meter, and it can observe it until May. So until May, we may be able to track better its trajectory, but maybe before we will have already eliminated the impact probability that there is an impact with Earth in 2032. So that's the key point, is to keep observing it. And that's what we are doing, pushing the limit of the observations so that we can make sure what is the impact probability before we lose it in April.
Okay, that's actually quite encouraging, because I was sort of wondering if on this, it's got a kind of 6 year, is it 5 year orbit, that we're not going to see it again till
June 2028.
So I don't want to be waiting that long to know that we're okay or not.
Absolutely, me too. So I'm still hopeful that the probability will be eliminated in all the solutions. But if not, then we also have another group endorsed by the UN, which is called the Space Mission Planning Advisory Group, that includes space agencies like the UK one, French one, Italian one, NASA, ESA, etc. And they are in charge of defining a response to this kind of threat. So if the probability is still not zero, then they will have to decide what the next action. But we are not yet there. They are planned to meet if the probability remains. So that's good news. But for now, all the efforts are to really determine what's the actual impact probability when we lose the object.
Okay, let's work through these things. If you don't mind, we're going to go down the gloom route now.
Yeah.
Because we do need to know those what could happen. This is not an existential threat to us, but it is a threat that could impact some tens of kilometers of Earth's surface if it did come down to us.
Yes, absolutely. This is just a small object. You know, the one that killed the dinosaurs was 10 kilometers in size, right? This one is between 40 and 90 meters in size, so much smaller than a football stadium. However, effectively, if it comes to Earth, we have at least one example of the damage caused by an object of 50 meters. This is the explosion of a bolide of this size on the 13th of June 1908 at 8 kilometers in the atmosphere over the forest of the Tunguska in Siberia. And that pulverized 2,000 kilometers squares of forest. So essentially, if an object of this size explodes over, you know, London or Paris, basically the whole city is affected. If it is larger, if it is more like 90 meters, then it's at a region scale that there will be damage. Now, one thing to remember is that this is still very local, and the Earth is covered by water and desert for the most part. So the likelihood of a local event to happen over an inhabited area remains very small. And we will be able, by, you know, following this object, and if it ever impact the Earth, to better determine where it should happen.
Well, that's what I was going to go on to ask. You know, it's one thing to say it's got a chance of hitting Earth. If in fact it becomes a 50% or 100% probability, what sort of warning would you be able to give us whether it would hit this part of the Earth or the other? Because the Earth is moving around the sun. It's also turning on its own axis. This thing's sort of sweeping through space. It's going to be a pretty difficult calculation, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. But we're doing it. And, you know, I mean, everything is, again, transparent because we want to make sure that the public understands how we do these things and show us that effectively we are, you know, well coordinated and know what we do with, of course, the information that we have. And for now, for instance, we already have what we call a corridor risk, which is basically a sort of if you take the globe of the Earth, and you trace a sort of a line around it, then we know where it could impact, where is the line on the globe, basically. And for now, it extends between the South Pacific to South Asia. So it would go from South Pacific to South America, then Atlantic Ocean, then Africa, and then Southeast India. This is where it could impact on the map for the moment, based on our information.
So in other words, if you were in a city along these lines, in a good sense, it might, you might see it flashing overhead, I don't know, by daylight or by nightfall. But if things are really unfortunate.
Yeah. I mean, well, the good news is that if you look at this line, most of it is made of ocean and desert. But effectively, these are the things that we are, you know, we do exercises to be prepared to this risk. And these are the things that we are also exercising, how to basically work with the civil protection to make sure that they are aware of a risk and to have plans for evacuating a city, etc., if it is really necessary. But again, for the moment, we don't have any reasons to have this scenario in mind. I mean, we have it in mind, of course. We are preparing for this kind of thing, but there is no reason to generate any actions for the moment, because that 2% chance of hitting the Earth is 98% chance of not hitting it. So for the moment, I would say...
I like your optimism, Patrick. if I may... You've been involved, I think, in this American project, this NASA project called DART, where they deliberately fired something the size of, I think, the size of a fridge or something like that, at a distant asteroid, probably one, what, a little bit bigger than this, to see if you could just shift its orbit a tiny amount as a means of planetary defence. I mean, if it came to that, what do we know about the prospects of doing this with this 2024 YR4?
Yeah, in September 2022, we had the DART mission by NASA that basically sent a 580-kilogram spacecraft on a 150-meter size asteroid called Dimorphos.
So that's slightly bigger.
Yes, and that was successful, noting that the challenge was already that we only knew the size of the object, but not the shape. And at 11 million kilometers from the Earth, the spacecraft had to navigate autonomously in order to target correctly the asteroid, and that was successful. And now we have launched the Hera mission by the European Space Agency last October to return on what I call, they don't like it in America, but the crime scene, like a detective, to investigate the efficiency of the deflection and characterize the asteroid. So already we have a test done, not on paper, but in reality. So that's good news. It was successful. We still have to measure correctly the efficiency. So we are not going blind if we do the same again. We have the technology. The only uncertainty that we have effectively is what the asteroid is made of, in addition to the size. Is it made of a spongy material? Is it made of very hard material? And of course, the response to an impact to deflect it highly depend on its properties. And effectively, if we have to launch a mission like this, we would have to go with some assumptions about those properties and maximize the energy we give to a spacecraft to make sure that we make the deflection.
And just to run through the exercise, not because it will be necessary this time, but let's imagine this is something our descendants may need to face. We would need to intercept this sometime in 2028 when it's next comes close, because otherwise we're never going to reach it. The deflection would only be very slight. How much would you change the probability of hitting the Earth? And obviously you want to make sure you don't go and do it wrong and it goes the wrong way.
Yeah, so first I would say that the responsibility of this answer goes to the Space Mission Planning Advisory Group, who is in charge of responding. So what I'm going to tell you is just my own perspective. In fact, I don't think we will do anything before 2028. I mean, we could, but time is short and there are many programs. This group will discuss about it if the probability remains. But the plan would be rather, for the moment, to check what happened when it come back in 2028, to observe again and check whether the probability is still there. And if it's still there, then effectively this will be time to react. It gives us only 4 years. It's short. It's very short. But, you know, DART was developed in a very short time scale. Hera also in only 4 years. So if there is motivation and if there is really necessity, I believe we can still do something if we decide in 2028. But this Space Mission Advisory Group may decide to start something before. I don't know. So for the moment, I would say it's still early to know. This object is between 40 and 90 meters. If we launch something quickly, we may be able to deflect it, even if we do it late. But again, that's not yet something that we really thought about carefully, because for the moment, we want to make sure about the probability of impact, and this is where the efforts are.
We met last April, Patrick, when you were running this big session about getting rockets and missions to go to this asteroid Apophis, which is going to be flying past very safely, but very close in 2029. And you said at the time that one of the things about doing this exercise was to see about the practicalities of getting a mission together really quickly. And I don't know that that's going as well as I would like.
No, I mean, look, we were already successful at ESA to develop Hera, which is a complex mission with a spacecraft and 2 CubeSats in only 4 years. Now we have this Ramses mission that should fly to Apophis if the Ministerial Council of ESA approve it in November. And the launch has to happen in 2028, so in only 3 years. And everybody working very hard to make it happen. So, you know, when there is motivation and when there is the budget for it, then we are very skilled and motivated, so we can do things. Of course, with a risk. I don't say it's easy, because if we decide to do something in 2028, we won't have any redundancy. We have to succeed, because we cannot have time to fail one time and then launch another mission. But, okay, that's a situation. It's very unlikely we have to deal with this issue. But that's why, I mean, we have already meetings planned by the Space Mission Planning Advisory Group in April, once we know the situation for 2024 YR4, and we will see what they decide to do. But the good thing is that everybody is aware of that. Everybody is thinking well about it, and decision will be taken that goes in the right direction.
And I think the other good news comes from history, that, like you say, we know of this asteroid similar, possibly, that struck the wilds of Siberia 100 and a bit years ago. There's nothing that we have in history where a city was ever wiped out by an asteroid like this. So I think history tells us that we're, we're generally pretty safe.
I fully agree. I mean, I'm not very worried. What I do in planetary defense is I hope useless for my lifetime, But also I know it is very important for a longer time scale. And in fact, my objective, and you could talk to other people involved, I think is the same, is to offer to the future generations a plan that works for all sorts of scenarios so that they don't have to improvise the day it happens. And hopefully this will happen in a longer time scale than in a shorter time scale, but we never know, because some people win in lotteries while the probability is low. So better safe than sorry. The advantage we have with this risk is that, contrary to many other natural risks like earthquakes or tsunamis, we cannot prevent them. Predicting them is very difficult. Preventing them is impossible. For the impact risk, it is possible to predict and prevent it with means that are feasible and reasonable. And I think it is our responsibility to have everything in place before it happens so that people can deal with other risks and be peaceful with this one. I often take the analogy with a pandemic, which is also a very low probability thing, but with high consequences. And we see that when we are not fully ready and coordinated internationally, it's very difficult to deal with it, as we have seen with the COVID-19. And for politicians, it must have been a nightmare. So I don't want that to happen for the impact risk for our future generations. And therefore, we do this. And I think the dinosaurs would envy us to think that way, although they are not here anymore to see that.
Planetary Defender Patrick Michel, stand by for an update late March, I guess. We'll keep across the threat from 2024 YR4 here on Science in Action from the BBC World Service. If you look at the statistics, things the size of 2024 YR4 hit the Earth around once every 100 to 1,000 years. Extinction-level events are once in 100 million years. On the other hand, millions of little meteoroids enter the atmosphere every day. If you're lucky, you'll see the streak of a shooting star left by their passage. The smallest things, subatomic neutrinos, streak through us by the gazillions every second, almost all of them without even being noticed.
Als mein Mitarbeiter plötzlich kündigte, musste mir schnell etwas einfallen, um die Aufträge weiterhin reibungslos ausführen zu können. Ich musste sofort eine Lösung finden. Da kam mir Indeed in den Sinn. Wenn es ums Einstellen geht, ist Indeed alles, was du brauchst. Mit gesponserten Stellen wird dein Angebot für relevante Kandidatinnen ganz oben auf der Seite platziert, damit du die gewünschten Personen schneller erreichst. Bevor ich von Indeed wusste, waren die Kandidatinnen oft nicht optimal, mal zu langsam oder unterqualifiziert. Dann fing ich wieder von vorne an mit einer neuen Stellenausschreibung. Das kostet Zeit und Geld. Wie schnell ist Indeed? In der Minute, in der ich mit dir gesprochen habe, wurden weltweit 23 Einstellungen über Indeed vorgenommen, laut Indeed-Daten. Es gibt keinen Grund zu warten. Beschleunige dein Recruiting jetzt mit Indeed. Und Hörerinnen dieser Sendung erhalten ein Guthaben von 75 Euro für eine gesponserte Stelle, damit dein Stellenangebot mehr Sichtbarkeit erhält auf indeed.de/podcast.de. Es gelten die allgemeinen Geschäftsbedingungen.
Science is done by people who constantly expect the unexpected.
That thing that we couldn't figure out, we figured it out. But now you're like, okay, this is like a whole other can of worms.
Unexpected Elements brings you the most unexpected bits.
At the origin of the lightning discharge, we have a temperature which is even higher than the surface of the sun.
Unexpected Elements from the BBC World Service. It's not Jurassic Park, is it?
It's Cretaceous Park. All of the dinosaurs in Jurassic Park came from the Cretaceous period.
Search for Unexpected Elements wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
But every now and then, one hits an atom and creates a flash that can be detected if you have the right equipment. And this week we learned of the most energetic ever measured, because European scientists did have the right cameras, for want of a better word, submerged under the Mediterranean Sea. Pascal Coyle leads the kilometre cubed network, as it's called.
The key part of our detector are beach ball sized spheres made of glass, so they're transparent. The glass is very thick because they will have to withstand a very high pressure when you go 3.5 kilometres under the sea. But the most important thing is inside the glass, we have lots of what we call photomultiplier tubes. And these are photosensors that can catch photons of light. And in fact, they're super sensitive. They can catch one photon of light to be triggered, whereas the human eye typically needs something like 7 photons to be detected. So they're better than the human eyes, the K3Net eyes.
And you've got, I mean, is it hundreds? You hang strings of these, is it, into the Mediterranean Sea?
Yes, the neutrinos are very, very difficult to catch. So we have to build an enormous telescope to be able to catch a few of them as they pass through the telescope. So we have something like 60,000 of these glass spheres in a big three-dimensional grid sitting on the seafloor, just waiting for the neutrinos to pass through.
As I understand it, you were still in the sort of development phase when 2 years ago, 2 years exactly on Thursday, a neutrino, is that right, flying from somewhere in the heavens, strikes an atom somewhere in the sea and produces this flash of light that all these sensors light up with.
Exactly, yeah. We detected the highest energy ever detected for a neutrino, 30 times higher than any previously detected neutrino, really in the energy range where nobody has looked before. So it's a completely unexplored range for exploring the universe.
And when does this show up? I mean, do you have computers that are sort of watching these things all the time and sending out alerts, and you're just about to go and get a cup of coffee or something and it goes ping?
Well, no, not quite like that. At the time we made the discovery, we had 21 detection strings in the water taking data. When we're finished, we hope to have over 200 of these strings. So the detection was made with only 10% of the telescope. And at that time, our alert system, it wasn't ready. So we weren't in a position then to send out alerts to all the other telescopes around the world. We didn't see it straight away. It takes a bit of time for us to process our data. So it wasn't really noticed till some time after it came through. But that's to say, once our alert system is in place, we will notice it within 20 seconds. The next time one arrives, we will know straight away.
It just reminds me very slightly of when they discovered the first gravitational wave about 10 years ago. Yes. They had also only just turned on the machine, and there's a certain amount of disbelief, I think, that maybe this was some glitch. You didn't have that concern.
Well, it was a surprise to us to detect such a high energy so early in the life of our experiment. Well, when we first saw it, of course, our first reaction is, wow, that can't be true, can it? So we spend a lot of time rechecking everything. So we're now completely convinced it's absolutely real. So that's why we're published.
And so it's not just that you detect the neutrino, but this is like a telescope. You can tell which direction it came from, can you?
Yes. In fact, the neutrino telescopes are really great. We can look in all directions all at once. We don't have to actually point the telescope in a particular direction to see.
And which way did it come from? I mean, was it overhead or what?
So this was horizontal. So it didn't come from above. It didn't come from below. It came in sideways.
Oh, right. Well, this, you're in the Mediterranean. So which direction did it come from then?
Yes. So it passed through Malta.
Mm-hmm.
So it came from the west to the east. It passed through 140 kilometres of sea and rock.
And then it just hit one atom somewhere in all that sea, and that's what you actually see.
Very luckily, it hit a molecule of water, and then the neutrino changed into a muon particle, which is like a heavy electron. You see, the neutrinos are incredibly difficult to detect because they have no charge. But once they interact, they will make other particles. It made a muon, and muons do have charge. And once you have a charged particle, and if the particle is moving faster than the speed of light inside the seawater, Then there's a special magic light that is produced called Cherenkov light.
You see this blue glow in reactor ponds that comes from it.
A blue glow of light just passing very quickly through our telescope. The neutrino and the muon are traveling essentially at the speed of light. So it took maybe 2 microseconds for the muon to travel through the telescope.
Now, as I understand it, to be that energetic, something has to make it that energetic, and that has to be something going on out in space, out in the cosmos, that's accelerated this thing way beyond any energy you get, for example, at the Large Hadron Collider.
Exactly, yeah. Actually, we know that somewhere in the universe there are what we call cosmic accelerators that do produce super high energy particles. And we know that because all the time there are cosmic rays bombarding the Earth. And sometimes these particles will have enormous energies, even higher than the energy we detected. But because of the cosmic rays are charged particles, they get all bent in the magnetic fields. So we can't really figure out very easily where they come from. So that's one of the really exciting things about detecting super high energy neutrinos, is because they are a neutral particle and they don't get bent in magnetic fields.
And this made a straight line to us.
They come in a straight line, and then if we look along that line, we can see where they come from in the sky. The kind of objects that possibly could make this particles at these energies would be what we call active galactic nuclei. These are galaxies where the supermassive black hole in the center of the galaxy is swallowing matter and growing. And in that process, it's possible to accelerate particles to these enormous energies.
It's sort of spitting stuff out as it swallows the rest.
Yeah, it kind of, some of the matter it doesn't like so much and it spits it out.
And so in a way, I mean, this one detection on its own won't give you enough information, but in a sense, this is a way of, to borrow the phrase, x-raying the heart of a black hole, as it were, to see what's going on where everything else is really quite confusing.
Yes, exactly. The neutrinos, they don't care how much matter is in the way, they just go through it without a problem. So the neutrinos we see can come from the very heart of all these cataclysmic events. Normally, the light we see from events with optical telescopes can only come from the surface. All the stuff that's happening inside the cataclysmic event has been absorbed, and it's only the neutrinos that can escape from the center of these objects. So that gives a completely unique and different view of these events. The other process that could also generate neutrino of this energy is when, we know the ultra-high-energy cosmic rays exist, the charged particles, but they're being bent by all the magnetic fields. But those cosmic rays, they can interact with photons left over from the Big Bang. And when they do that, they will also make neutrinos. So another possible explanation would be what we call a cosmogenic neutrino.
I want you to know that neutrinos are, I think, my favourite subatomic particle, by the way. I think they are amazing things because they're dealing with just the most weird force of nature, the weak force. Anyway, that's a by the by, possibly. It does seem to me that there may be a danger that this experiment peaked too early, and that this will be the highlight of your, as it were, of your career. Or do you think that when the full experiment is going, will you keep on breaking records? Are you probing things that you just didn't expect to probe, I guess, in the physics of the universe?
Well, I agree with you that neutrinos are the most fascinating of the elementary particles, because they have zero charge, zero size, almost zero mass, almost zero interaction. And in fact, they're the closest thing to nothing one can imagine. But yet they really hold the key to fully understanding the universe. I think we're all very excited with operating the telescope for 2 years, and we've we've made such an important discovery. We're optimistic that this won't be the only event, but as the experiment grows and as we take more data, we hope to catch more of these.
Pascal Coyle of Aix-Marseille University. Full details of the detection are reported in Nature this week. Finally, with yet another record testing month of global temperatures just recorded, the ongoing efforts to reduce the greenhouse gases that drive global warming. Methane is one we keep returning to, more powerful though shorter-lived than CO2. Up to 40% of the human-driven emissions come from rice paddies because of the stagnant, swampy waters the crops are grown in. Better crop management can reduce those emissions, but that takes effort. I was surprised to learn this week that the rice plants themselves contribute to the flux by inadvertently feeding the methane-emitting microbes through their roots. Crop trials of a new variety in China show massive improvements, and Anna Schnurer was the microbiologist on the team to see why.
So the rice plant is typically grown underwater, and that creates an environment where you have limited oxygen entering the soil. And that promotes so-called anaerobic microorganisms. They are growing very well under those conditions. And among those are the methane-producing archaea. Actually, they are not bacteria, but archaea, another type of microorganism. But they like the oxygen-free environment.
Now, the bit which I didn't realise until I saw your paper was that, in fact, the rice plants themselves are sort of encouraging these particular archaea. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So it's actually not only rice that feeds microbes. All plants or many plants are feeding microbes around the roots because the microbes are helping them to kind of recover nutrients from the environment. So it's kind of a situation where the plant and the microbes are helping each other. But the plant is releasing organic compounds into the soil, which are feeding microorganisms. And in the case of the rice and the specific rice that we have investigated, we saw a link between specific compounds and the methane production.
So what you're saying is that by targeting some of the metabolism of the rice plants, you can actually reduce the amount of methane that's produced in the muddy water around the plant.
Yes, so we identified the compounds that were specifically linked to the methane production, and then by breeding, we have managed to have a rice variety that secretes less of this specific compound. So this new rice variety is cutting the methane emissions by up to 70% that are commercially used today. Yes, it's a lot.
Without harming the plant itself?
Yes, the plant is perfectly happy. It's even having slightly higher yields than the average rice plants.
Would it be easy for farmers to adopt?
Yes, I mean, this is a rice variety with good yields, so there is no other, there is not a reason why you shouldn't use it. It cannot be grown in all temperature regions. So we have many places in China where it can be grown or in the world, but not in more temperate regions, so climates where you have a little bit more tropic conditions.
I'm curious, so this is a tweak in the genetics for one of the metabolic pathways of the plants. Presumably this could be bred into other varieties because there are so many varieties of rice grown across the world. But in principle, this could be done in other varieties?
Yes. So, this is a breeding approach that we have used. So we were screening a lot of old rice varieties, not commercially used today. And that one was used for breeding.
Right. I was quite curious about the story of this, whether this has been sort of a defect that's been unintentionally bred into modern rice varieties, this methane producing. And if you go back to ancestral strains, they were more efficient, shall we say, in terms of their metabolism.
Yes, we could say something like that, because what we do when we are breeding, we are usually going for the high yield varieties. And when you have done that in this case, we have at the same time got varieties that are causing a lot of methane. While the old varieties, they are more efficient, as you say, and they are not releasing so much carbon into the soil. But if you take one of these old varieties and breed with a more modern high-yielding variety, which we have done, then we have got a type that is both having small amounts of methane and at the same time high yields.
Microbiologist Anna Schnurer of Uppsala Biocentre in Sweden. go to the journal Molecular Plant for all the details. Well, that's it for Science in Action from the BBC this week. Do join me, Roland Pease, and producer Alex Mansfield, same time next week for another bout.
Science is done by people who constantly expect the unexpected.
That thing that we couldn't figure out, we figured it out. But now you're like, okay, this is like a whole other can of worms.
Unexpected Elements brings you the most unexpected bits.
At the origin of the lightning discharge, we have a temperature which is even higher than the surface of the sun.
Unexpected Elements from the BBC World Service. It's not Jurassic Park, is it?
It's Cretaceous Park. All of the dinosaurs in Jurassic Park came from the Cretaceous period.
Search for Unexpected Elements wherever you get your BBC podcasts.